Chapter 14, Road to Highgate. The main thoroughfare between Twistyard and Highgate was compacted flat like pavement, and wound back and forth through fields and forests, gradually gaining elevation. Because it was built for all sorts of wagons and heavy loads, it wasn't the fastest route. Dilly wanted speed in order to catch up with Sir Lonk, so she insisted they leave the well-paved lane for Coyote Trail, which didn't even slightly resemble a road. It was like a dried-out avalanche chute. It went nearly straight up, a steep, rocky hill, before reaching a more manageable path on the other side. The shortcut would reduce the first third of their journey significantly, and from the top of the rise, before dropping down to where the trail bisected the road, Deer Leg Lookout Point would offer a perfect place to scope for Sir Lonk and his wife. Unfortunately, the moment Dodd left the thoroughfare, the horse he was riding, Brown Sugar, began to fuss. The mare had already trotted awkwardly, and now, despite Dodd's attempts to straighten her out, she wasn't responding. And with rocks jutting out of the ground on both sides, it was dangerous to wander even an inch from the path. "I don't think my horse likes the terrain," yelled Dodd to the others, who were quite a few paces ahead. Boot called back casually over his shoulder, "Give her a gentle kick, and she'll follow the rest of us." Dodd proceeded to nudge Brown Sugar, and it worked. She did move faster, though something wasn't right about the way she trotted. Each step jolted excessively or jiggled unsteadily. It was like riding a ticking time bomb. And with the dodgy landscape surrounding the cantankerous mare and the distance that Dodd still had to go, he felt disaster was certain. Not to mention, Boot's horse in front of him didn't seem to sway at all. It wasn't fair. As Dodd pressed forward, each minute was filled with terror. The path continued to get steeper, and his friends, who clearly had spent a lot of time riding horses, were breaking away from him, eager to be done with Dilly's shortcut. "My horse is acting weird," Dodd finally called out desperately, his voice quivering. He hoped at least Boot would be able to still hear him and help. "I'm not sure what's wrong. Can we please stop for a minute to take a look?" "At the top," responded Boot loudly, grunting as he pulled arduously on the reins of his horse. "The hill's too steep right here. We'd better wait until we're on the level bluff. Besides, I'm starving, aren't you?" Dodd tried to press on with courage, but a prevailing feeling of concern washed over him. Something was definitely wrong. He looked down at his horse's legs as she clanked up the rocky slope. They appeared fine. However, when a bothersome stone in the path neared the mare's front steps, the horse bucked and swayed. It was then that Dodd realized giant thorns were concealed beneath Brown Sugar's long, dark hair that hung just above her hooves like black socks. A few spiny quills protruded far enough to be visible, and even then, Dodd only noticed them because he saw how the mare reacted when she gingerly bumped against the taller rocks. "I have a problem," yelled Dodd in panic. He was petrified. "I need help!" Boot and Buck turned in curiosity and found Dodd was no longer behind them on the trail. He was passing them, white-knuckled and bulging-eyed, heading hazardously through jagged rocks on the steep hillside. And with each painful step, the distressed horse was spurred to heightened levels of spastic movements. She had become a bucking bronco, with Dodd riding like a gold-buckled cowboy, his life depending on it. To make matters worse, Dodd's riggings were falling off. He clung to the reins for all he was worth, attempting to dismount the faltering saddle and plant himself on the horse's bare back. Perhaps if the ground were level, it would have been possible, but with so many opposing variables, it wasn't. Dodd flew through the air, arms and legs flailing. "Boot!" he cried. The horse had launched Dodd sideways right over the top of many knife-like stones, smack dab into Boot. It was unbelievably lucky. He flopped across the front of Boot's lap, with his pants catching on the saddle, causing them to tear. "If you wanted to ride with me," Boot said playfully, "you should have asked. No need for these crazy games." He was joking, though his trembling voice and gaping-mouthed look relayed heavy concern over what had just happened. Dodd struggled to readjust, while everyone else watched the frenzied mare. It bucked and kicked on the slope, clanking and clattering against the rocks, and completely fell down twice. It finally staggered toward the base of the hill, miraculously still alive. Once on flatter ground, Brown Sugar leapt into a clumsy run, zigzagging and disappeared into the distance. "Wow," said Buck, shocked by the spectacle. "You would have been worm meat if you had stayed on that crazy thing. I wonder what got into her. She's been Uke's favorite horse for over 10 years, his first choice by far. I hope she finds her way back to Twistyard." "She better," growled Dilly, incensed, her eyes narrowing as she glared at Dodd. "Yuke trusted me with that horse." "It's not my fault," responded Dodd, feeling guilty. He went on to explain about the thorns and loose saddle, but they weren't good enough excuses. Dilly offered no words of sympathy. Nevertheless, after the group had made it safely to the flats, Dilly admitted it was possible that foul play was involved. "We will at least need to be careful," she concluded as she pulled out her book of everything. She scribbled vigorously a page of notes, while Boot dismounted his stallion and searched for thorns. Sawney prodded her horse over to an outcropping where she used her noculars to scan for Sir Lonk and Junie. "It looks like we're right on track to merge with the others," she said, quickly locating them. "At the pace they're going, I judge we'll easily hit the big bend in the road before they do. And Dilly, did you mention who was accompanying them? I thought they were going alone, just a family gathering. But someone else is riding along." Dilly didn't know anything about the mystery person, so it fueled the journey into a faster-than-needed descent through the meadows. Dodd enjoyed riding double with Boot on Yuke's larger horse. It was a beautiful chestnut with reddish streaks, and its legs were longer than Song's, making it effortless to keep up with Dilly. They rode smoothly across the grassy fields toward the road, almost as if they were floating. It was remarkably more comfortable than the best of moments Dodd had experienced on the mare, and that was despite being positioned on the horse's bare back, behind Boot's saddle. As they flew, Dodd listened. Boot told two fascinating tales about the stallion they were riding. He had a gift for telling stories. "Pius gave Yuke this war horse to thank him," said Boot, setting the stage. "This horse was the last colt of Rosiana, you know, the mare Donis rode to victory at the Battle of Rocky Ridge. After successfully taking the pole tower, Donis let Rosiana run free in the meadows below, symbolically representing the freedom of the people." Dodd nodded his head, as though he remembered. However, tales of Rosiana were blurred from the unusual set of memories he did have of Donis and Boloth at Rocky Ridge. It didn't matter to the conversation. Dodd was sitting behind Boot, and Boot couldn't hear a nod. "Ironically," said Boot, in a melodramatic voice, "Big Red, the horse Drake was riding when he led the opposition against Donis, was left to himself in the fields after the battle, the same fields Rosiana roamed. It wasn't long before this horse came along, streaked with blood red like his father. Shortly thereafter, Rosiana died protecting her colt from none other than Big Red. The villagers of Rocky Ridge were outraged, and they shot Big Red for his offense. That's where this horse got his woeful name, Shooter." "Oh, that's how he got his name," piped Dodd to keep the conversation flowing. He really hadn't known the horse's name in the first place. "Yep, that's how he got it," said Boot, nodding in rhythm with the horse's gallop. "After that, some people saw this horse as a symbol of hope and freedom because of Rosiana. She bore him as a free mare in the fields and then died protecting him. Others, of course, noticed the bloody streaks and quickly remembered the tyrannical offenses of Drake and the cruelty of Big Red murdering Rosiana. That's why Pius got the horse in the first place. I suppose if this stallion were only brown, he'd still be lazily chewing grass in the fields below the pole tower at Rocky Ridge. And let me tell you, that would be a tragedy." "Really?" said Dodd. He didn't mean to actually say anything. It just slipped out. In his mind, it didn't sound so bad for the horse to have remained roaming free, representing something Rosiana had started. Besides, if Boot wanted to use the word tragedy, he could have used it next to the horrible deeds of Big Red or the orphaning of poor Shooter. "Well, definitely," insisted Boot. "I think you could call it a tragedy if something as great as this horse never got its chance to shine, to truly be special. Don't you think so?" "I guess," said Dodd in a reserved voice. "It would be like Humberone never getting his chance to save the day, or even like Pap. You know, what if Pap had spent his life sitting around getting old, never doing what he was made to do, never drawing a sword, never saving people, and never teaching us to follow? Why, Pap alone left a giant legacy of good, not to mention Humberone. It would have been a tragedy if they were content to be anything less than they were made to be." Dodd realized he didn't know very much about the accomplishments of the horse he was riding, so he quickly consented to Boot that he was right. He also found Boot's comments fascinating, especially for his unique circumstance. Dodd felt his heart pound with pride as he thought about Pap, who had taken the opportunities afforded him by the charm and had flourished with them. "You know, Boot," said Dodd, "the more I think about it, the more right you are." "And it's taken you all of this time to figure it out?" joked Boot. "I should have warned you when we first met that I would always be right. I could have saved you the mental effort." "No," responded Dodd. "I mean about becoming. We mostly think about tragedy in terms of what has happened, not what could have happened." "All right, you're getting close to losing me," said Boot. That was almost a Sonny phrase, quoted straight from Driggin's Truths About Life. "It was your idea," said Dodd, jabbing Boot in the side with his fist. "I just restated it." "Really, Sonny? Is that what I said?" mocked Boot in his precious Dilly voice. "Yes, Dilly," said Dodd, playing along. "And it makes a lot of sense." Dodd smiled as he thought about becoming like Pap. He felt destined to greatness, bound by his genetics and unique circumstance, and determined to give his best effort to do it. After all, time did indeed stand still for him, too. Or at least he hoped it did. "So, tell me your favorite story about this horse. When was his best moment?" asked Dodd. He enjoyed Boot telling him stories. "That's easy. Pius was outnumbered 12-1 fighting against Rudarius and his porlings on the shores of Lake Zulritter. He had taken a firm stand by having his men camp in the thick trees on the top of 6 plateaus. Every night they set fires along all of the cliff edges, creating the appearance that their army was equal in number. Men on flutters couldn't count heads from above the tight tree cover, and any that ventured below were easily shot down. The guys worked for months. Meanwhile, Commendus raised a formidable force. It was Uke's brilliant idea." "I remember a little bit about the battle," said Dodd honestly, recalling parts of it. "But how does Shooter enter in?" "Keep listening and you'll see. He's a real hero," said Boot, turning momentarily to smile at Dodd. Pius received word from Commendus that he had gathered together an impressive number of troops, and that they were currently camping in Sunic Valley, about 5 hours' march from the plateaus. It was wonderful news. Unfortunately, Dardarius had his spies and knew of their approach. He decided to ambush them that night. By the cloak of darkness, thousands of porlings marched quietly past the plateaus, far enough away to avoid being struck by stones or arrows. They headed straight for the sleeping men in Sunic Valley. At first, Pius ordered his troops to descend in an effort to stop them, but they were met with such heavy opposition they quickly retreated back to the safety of the plateaus. Only one road led down from each, so it was easy for Dardarius to set troops at the bases, assuring nobody escaped to tell. He also hadn't seen any flutters used during the prior weeks, which led him to correctly assume that they didn't have any. Pius and his men were helpless, unable to get word to their unsuspecting friends. "Oh, yes, I remember now. Was Shooter the horse?" "Yep, he's the one," said Boot, patting Shooter on his neck. Pius knew he couldn't let his friends in Sunic Valley be ambushed during the night, and he had already tried the blocked road down the plateau, so that only left one option: test the legend of the wild horse. Dodd felt a wave of excitement when Boot mentioned the legend. Everyone had heard it. Hundreds of years before, men had rounded up nearly all of the stray horses in the Lake Zulritter area to break in as stock horses. However, one strong stallion kept eluding them. In an attempt to catch the magnificent animal, 200 men chased him up the only passable trail to the wooded flats of Doran Plateau. They thought they had him, but for his freedom he jumped the 7 steps. 7 plateaus that each decreased in size and were each separated by 20-30 foot wide gullies, the shallowest of which dropped hundreds of feet. After that, nobody tried to touch the stallion. He had earned his freedom. "Oh, it was at the 7 steps, said Dodd. That's how Pius did it." Boot paused for a minute and began shaking his head side to side. It looked like he was saying no, until Dodd realized Boot was trying to shake loose a few bees out of his hair. They had ridden through a small swarm, and since Dodd was sitting lower down, without a saddle, and was directly behind Boot as a shield, he hadn't been hit by any of them. "I hate bees," whined Boot, brushing the last one from his right ear. "Anyway, as I was saying, Pius was a firm believer that Shooter represented liberty, and as Rosianna's colt, surely he could take the 7 steps to freedom. In a bold move, Pius left the command of his armies to his son Bravus and took the ride of his life. He jumped all 7 gullies and rode across the steps. He's the only one I know of who's tried it and lived to tell." On the flats, Shooter continued to trot all night. Pius quietly rode past the porlings and lit fires in the trees and brush all along the front line. At first, he did it to awaken his friends in Sunic Valley. However, the prevailing winds blew the flames toward the Porlings in great swirling torrents and created such a barrier that they turned and fled back to the sandy shores of Lake Zolritter. More than half of the Porlings deserted Dredarius that night, out of superstition, citing that the pay wasn't high enough to fight against the monsters of fire. Dredarius lost so many men to false notions that he had to retreat and completely abandon his designs for 2 years. In the morning, as soon as Pius dismounted, Shooter lay down and couldn't get up without help. It turned out he had fractured one of his legs while jumping the 7 steps, but despite his injury, he hadn't stopped moving until the battle had been prevented. Now doesn't that sound like a true hero? Dodd nodded his head and patted Shooter with one hand, still clinging tightly to Boot with the other. He couldn't help feeling envious of Uke for owning such a wonderful horse. When the group met up with Sir Lonk and Juni, they were happily surprised to find out that Strat was the mystery man. He was heading to Rawl for a meeting with his good friend Bly, who was currently spending time away from Highgate, improving a few new technologies. Dilly popped the question about Duchy and found Sir Lonk and Strat both willing to check in on him. But when Strat mentioned that it would increase his stay an extra day or two, Boot quickly intervened. "Sir Lonk," he said in a most respectful voice, "I think it would be fitting if you stopped in on Duchy. Why, after all these years of him idolizing you, maybe he would decide to come back, as a demoted Rawling, of course, if you gave him a word of encouragement." "Yes, I suppose I should be the one to see his face," responded Sir Lonk arrogantly, looking down his nose at Strat. "I'm certain he'd prefer a chit with me over him. No offense, Strat, but a legendary swordsman from Rawl commands a certain level of admiration. It beats a mere Belurse enthusiast, 10-1, rain or shine, and in your home stadium, too. Silly sports can't compare to real skills." Dilly's eyes rolled to Boot, disgusted by Sir Lonk's attitude, and in acknowledgement that she understood Boot's motive for speaking up was to make sure his beloved Belurse game against Rawl Hall was not postponed. Though she didn't say anything, it still served her purpose of dismissing another duty on her lengthy list of things to do. Dodd glanced momentarily at Strat, right in the middle of Sir Lonk's slam on him, wondering how he would respond. But he didn't. He spoke to Dodd instead. "Trumpy, Dodd. You don't like horses either?" asked Strat, noting that Dodd rode double with Boot. Strat looked motion sick, slumping on the back of a beautiful black mare. Not only did he ignore Sir Lonk's degrading jab, he didn't even seem bothered by it. He could have been if he wanted to. Strat had earned the right to get annoyed by statements like that, for he was the instigator of a 6-year winning streak at Belurse, claiming the golden swat for Twistyard, and with Rawl Cousings no less. It was akin to being the head coach of a team that repeatedly triumphed at the Super Bowl. "No," responded Dodd. "It's not that I don't like them. I just don't seem to be very lucky with them. My horse had problems coming up Coyote Trail, so when she ran off, I ended up on the back of Shooter here." Dodd gave the horse a pat. "What kind of trouble?" asked Strat. He tried to straighten up, and his eyes flashed with excitement, breaking through the nausea momentarily. Dodd wanted to be frank and discuss the suspicious thorns, yet caution held him to a conservative response. "My horse didn't like the steep hill with rocks. Maybe there was a burr in her saddle or something. Anyway, she bucked me off and ran back to Twistyard." "Really?" said Strat. "How strange. Just this morning, poor Sir Lonk nearly took a spill when his horse had problems with the riggings. Didn't you, Sir Lonk?" Juni, Dilly, Sir Lonk, and Buck were so busy talking that Sir Lonk didn't hear Strat. Boot gave Shooter an extra nudge and jolted forward, sliding between Dilly and Sir Lonk, which abruptly cut their conversation. "Strat just told us your saddle didn't like you this morning," said Boot in a sedated, teasing voice. "Yes, I could have died," said Sir Lonk dramatically. "Some decipitous Coranus handled my riggings today. It's the last time I'll let that happen. Zerny or one of his grubby barn handlers, no doubt, must have neglected their sleep and accidentally missed a hitch. Of course, if I knew it was purposeful, I'd invite the knave to meet the end of Jilser." "Dodd had issues with his horse, too," added Dilly, trying to worm her way back into the conversation. "His circumstance, however, was more precarious, I must confess. We didn't discover the problem until nearly halfway up Coyote Trail, at which time he had to abandon the mare or die on the rocks." "My goodness," gasped Juni. Her proud face showed some concern, though more theatrical than genuine. Juni was dressed in elegant layers of clothing. Her color choices were white, pink, and maroon, with a rose-tinted cape adorned by gold rings and beading that nearly covered the back of her prancing horse, It was in danger of being soiled if the horse listened to nature's call. Her face was long and slender, matching her tall, skinny body, and straight midnight black hair flowed down her back, nearly to her waist. She looked and played the part of a queen. "I'm sure necessity would have forced me to react similarly if we had scaled Coyote Trail," grumbled Sir Lonk, exuding disdain for any remark that placed his horse experience as being inferior. "I simply chose a better path from the start." "Certainly, my sovereign," said Juni patronizingly. "We are all glad you were wise enough to escape harm's way. Unfortunately, if Dodd had troubles as you did, how many trees need to fall before it's not just the wind?" "That's true. I fear you are right," responded Sir Lonk solemnly. "And what a coward the perpetrator must be to not face us man to man." Sir Lonk glanced at Dodd and smiled coolly. "My dearest Juni, when we return, I shall inquire of Yuke, whom he constrained to prepare our horses. Even with an impaired arm, I would gladly face the rascal. What a chicken-hearted play indeed, troubling us like that." "So, Dodd, do you know who set your horse for you?" I'm not exactly sure," stuttered Dodd, not wanting to give out key information. He looked at the ground and avoided Sir Lonk's eyes. The news that Sir Lonk's ride had been blighted was a definite sign that someone purposefully intended harm. Nevertheless, providing the truth openly to an angered pair of aristocrats didn't seem wise. If Sir Lonk reacted hastily with his sword, the real troublemaker, who was probably the Dread, would slither away like a startled snake in the bushes. "If I had a guess," raged Sir Lonk conceitedly, "it was that frazzle-bearded, tippity-nosed Zerny, or one of his similarly pathetic drat helpers. Ever since he led me into that bloody trap with his friends, he's acted standoffish. I can't logically understand why Bamboo tolerates such incompetence, except that he himself is too old to see it." "He's a kind man," said Strat, trailing behind the others, but spurring his horse to speed up enough to enter the conversation. It was fortunate Strat spoke up, or Dilly would have burst. Nobody spoke ill of Bamboo in front of her without incurring an outpouring of wrath. Dodd tilted his head and took a second peek at the celebrated Belurs instructor. Strat wasn't much to look at. His pants and shirt were typical small village homespun. His right boot was visible, with a hole in the toe. His height and body build was a short average for a grown treader. His mud-brown hair was messy, spiking in clumps recklessly on his head, and his face was sunburned and peeling with sparse stubble on his lip and chin only. The one exception to Strat's otherwise ordinary appearance was his daring eyes. Clearly, he was mellow enough not to challenge Sir Lonk over a rude comment made about him, and he was unquestionably ill from riding a horse. But Strat was not afraid of Sir Lonk, and his eyes seemed to say that he wasn't afraid of anything. "Come now, my Chantilly friend," said Strat as he guided his horse in Stoleboot's position. "I won't hear disparagement about Bamboo. He's equal to your brother Tarot in class, and he's more than surpassed him in wisdom from age. So let's tread carefully, dear companions." Strat spoke with a smile on his face, yet not a word of it was facetious. He meant them all. Sir Lonk became inflamed with controlled anger. His ears turned red and his nostrils twitched slightly. If fire could have come from his eyes, Strat would have become a pile of ashes in an instant. "I don't recall ever inviting you to use my family name," chided Sir Lonk coldly. "I would appreciate more respect in the future. Good day." Juni and Sir Lonk took the lead and quickly upped their pace until they parted from the others, far enough to be out of hearing range. Song tried to join them until Dilly restrained him. The Chantillys needed their space. At the outskirts of Highgate, the group met up with Sir Lonk and Juni again. However, this time there was a crowd of hundreds of other people, so direct conversation with them wasn't necessary. Dodd and Boots stayed on Shooter while the others dismounted their horses and mingled with the people. Dilly was in her element, socializing with acquaintances she hadn't seen in a long time. Everyone was waiting in and around a large open pavilion. The road widened out directly in front of the structure and continued without any bends for about a mile, where another pavilion full of people stood. Beyond the second edifice, Highgate towered majestically above the fields, crowning multiple hilltops with buildings, houses, roads, castles, and gardens. An old 15-foot stone wall surrounded Highgate, with lookout towers interrupting the battlement every couple of miles. In front of the wall, light green fields of well-grazed grass extended for a few hundred yards, completely void of trees and bushes. cows meticulously searched, cropping anything higher than an inch. In contrast, lush grass, bushes, and tall trees grew directly next to the depleted fields. It was as if someone had drawn an imaginary impassable line, which the cows all respected. As noon approached, the crowd grew impatient, waiting for something to happen. One bobwhip man, with all 4 feet of him dressed in a stately suit, stood near the front, holding the reins to a horse that was laden with goods. Next to him, a large wagon pulled by a team of horses was filled with nicely dressed treaders. A little girl sat toward the front and held a shaggy brown dog in her lap. Situated in the wagon was also a boy about the same age as the girl, who kept poking the dog with a stick every time the girl looked away. One large poke was too much for the crabby dog to take. It leapt from the girl's lap, flying out of the wagon, and landed on the ground, barking obnoxiously at the base of the wheels. The neighboring horse, loaded with bobwhip tradables, broke free of its master and bolted forward down the road, heading straight for Highgate. It only went about 200 feet before bucking uncontrollably. It reeled back and forth, spilling most of its load to the ground, and then it made its way in the opposite direction, running right past the pavilion at racing speed. "Poor horse," said Boot, cringing sympathetically. He shook his head as he spoke to Dodd. "I once tried walking into that barrier. It was a stupid dare. The noise inside my head was extremely loud, even though I covered my ears, and my insides felt like they were going to explode. It looks like nothing, but there's something very real surrounding the city. I think the Modge were brilliant, inventing the invisible tri-blot barrier. It's pathetic we haven't the slightest clue about how to replicate it or how to create new tri-blots." Dong! A large bell hung in the distant pavilion declared the beginning of the process of dropping the barrier. Dong, dong! Another bell from the first watchtower responded. Dong, dong, dong! The next watchtower continued the musical chain. Bells pealed from one tower to another, becoming quieter until they could no longer be heard. Dot assumed it was the official announcement to enter safely. "Shall we get going?" he asked naively. "In a minute," said Boot. "We don't want to enter until the lead guard tower indicates the barrier is down. You can't see the tri-blot field, so you have to trust the bells. Besides, I always let someone else go first, just in case." After a while of waiting, a quiet sound of ringing bells chimed from the other side of Highgate. "See, here it comes," said Boot. "Dong, dong, dong." 32, counted Boot. "That means they have only 3 more towers to go." "What are they doing?" asked Dodd. "Getting ready. There are 35 towers around Highgate, and each one must initiate a tri-blot drop-down sequence. When the tower peels its number, it means their portion of the shield is ready to come down, and the guards are on watch, prepared for an attack." "Wow, that's quite a system," said Dodd. He was impressed by the continued alertness of the troops, armed with swords for defense and equipped with unusually loud bells for communication. When the 35th tower indicated its number, it then began a quick one-dung chain from tower to tower. Within less than 2 minutes, the chain had made its way entirely around the city, reconnecting with the beginning, whereupon an extra loud dong sounded. That was the final signal that the shield was officially down. All of the waiting people made a rush for the wide lane, with Dodd and Boot lingering back, pausing until Dilly and Sonny had remounted their horses. Those exiting had freedom to go as they pleased. However, all of the individuals entering Highgate were met by a battalion of soldiers. Proper papers indicating approval to enter were needed in order to pass the guards. Dilly showed a fearsome treader Dodd's note from Commendus and then pointed at Sonny, Buck, Boot, and Dodd. The guard looked the group over and nodded his head. Most of the people entering showed papers or badges and were admitted relatively quickly. 2 carts were detained for a time, while soldiers searched their contents, but shortly thereafter were sent on their way. The only apparent exemptions to the rule for entrance were Sir Lonk and Junie. They proceeded forward into the crowd of soldiers and continued on without showing any paperwork or even saying so much as hello.